The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Armcast, Dead Sexy Podcast. I'm your host, Armand Rosamilia. Fridays exclusively on Project Entertainment Network, where I interview authors, publishers, editors, artists, filmmakers, narrators, the lady from Walmart, whoever I feel like talking to. That's every Friday, Armcast, right here on Project Entertainment Network.
Hey folks, I want to tell you about some friends of mine, Crystal Lake Publishing. You know, with unmatched success since 2012, Crystal Lake Publishing has quickly become one of the world's leading indie publishers of horror, mystery, thriller, and suspense books with a dark fiction edge. Yeah, love it. Crystal Lake Publishing is run by a truly international team led by South Africa's Joe Meinhardt, and they put integrity, honor, and respect at the forefront of their operations. So folks, I want you to visit crystallakepub.com for more information on Crystal Lake Publishing, Tales from the Darkest Depths. That's crystallakepub.com for more information on Crystal Lake Publishing, Tales from the Darkest Depths. I promise you, you're going to love it. Monster Attack is coming right up after this word from our sponsor, Subculture Corsets and Clothing. Hey, creepy McCreep persons. Looking for something out of the box to wear? Then you better visit subculturecorsets.com. Subculture Corsets and Clothing carries all of the unusual clothing and accessory brands for the steampunk, gothic, apocalypse, rockabilly, and pimp scenes. Or perhaps you're into Victorian goth. Whatever you freaks are into, most likely Subculture Corsets and Clothing will have something for you. Now, if you're a curvy lady, Subculture offers sizes 4 through 4X and men's clothing as well, so no excuses. Visit subculturecorsets.com now for that new exciting piece, or visit their store at the Avenue Mall in Jacksonville, Florida, located a half a mile off I-95. When checking out on Subculture's website, use the discount code MONSTERATTACK for 10% off your entire order. That's subculturecorsets.com. Discount code MONSTERATTACK. Check them out now.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy. Modern man has never fought.
Tell them we do not realize your energy is a stellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Monster Attack. You know, I've been looking over some of the previous shows that we've done in the last few months, and we seem to be sort of hovering around the late 50s right now. We've got another one for you today from 1959, and we had been, these past few shows, sort of concentrating on a couple of very popular character actors from the monster movie genre, some of my favorites as a kid growing up. Of course, last week we were looking at John Agar and John Carradine. And we've got two more for you in the film that we're going to be talking about this week. Of course, one who's an actor that I have the greatest amount of respect for and I think has gotten a bad knock over the years. And that's Lon Chaney Jr., who was, I think, absolutely brilliant in The Wolfman. And I think he also distinguished himself quite well in films that he did after that. In this film, it is right at the beginning of the time in Lon Chaney's career when things are going downhill a little bit. And I hate that a lot of people, and there's a couple of generations that when they think of Lon Chaney Jr., they only think of him in the years, in those final years where he was drinking very heavily and not in very good health. But this is one of those films where he's still hanging in there, but he's 14 years away from dying. I guess I better tell you the film we're going to talk about here. We're talking about 1959's The Alligator People. And this is really about the time that Chaney started making some really low-budget horror films. And, you know, unfortunately, his career starts going downhill. But I think he distinguishes himself pretty well in The Alligator People. One of the next character actors we're going to be talking about is George McCready. And George McCready has that deep classically trained delivery. He would be perfect in a Shakespearean a film or stage play. And he played a wide variety of films. He wasn't just in horror films. He was in a lot of films. I remember one of the last ones I remember seeing him in. He did have a tremendous part in Tora, Tora, Tora. And he also appeared, I think one of his last horror films was in Count Yorga, a film that we reviewed here about a year ago. And he did that as a favor for his son who was producing that film. Now, the other one that we're going to be talking about is Beverly Garland. And I know a lot of people think of Beverly Garland strictly as the woman who captured Fred McMurray's heart in My Three Sons when that show was near the end. I mean, you know, once you married off Fred McMurray's character, then the show sort of took a whole different meaning. But Beverly Garland also appeared in a lot of low-budget horror films, and one that we also talked about here a little more than a year ago, It Conquered the World. She had a little bit of a tie-in with Roger Corman's bunch. So she was seen in a plethora of films from the 50s all the way up into the 80s leading up to her death. She was a very, very active actress right up until the time she died while she was in her early 80s. So, and Beverly Garland was always a favorite of mine. In 1959, she's in her early 30s. She's still a very, very glamorous gal. Actually, you know, Beverly Garland kept her looks for the longest time. And but in this one, she is definitely a romantic female heartthrob type. I mean, she's definitely one that all the teenage boys, I'm sure, really fell in love with, one that I was attracted to as well when I first saw this film in the mid-60s. Now, this film gets a lot of grief. And it has over the years. It's been kidded around a lot. It's been made fun of a lot. And I'm going to tell you right up front, folks, in the beginning of this podcast, I'm not going to be brutalizing this film. Yeah, there are some ridiculous elements to the script writing. Yeah, there are some. Is the acting horrible? No, not really. Actually, the acting in this is pretty good. And you've got a you know, with Chaney and Garland, MacReady, and Richard Crane, who plays the sort of the main protagonist in this film. He is the victim in this movie. The acting, the performances are pretty good. Sometimes the script's a little crazy, and there may be a little bit of a problem with some makeup, but overall, this is a pretty good little film. Now, it only runs a little more than an hour. It's an hour and 17 minutes, so it's another, again, one of those really short, compressed films that ran on double bills with other films, other short films on the B circuit side. And also, this was a drive-in fare. This is a perfect drive-in movie for the 60s and the 70s. And this one made quite a run on the TV side. It made several appearances on the Monster Movie Matinee shows. And it was a favorite of John Zacherle's. So any of you listening here who grew up in California and had a chance to watch Zacherle do his horror hosting, this was one he especially liked. And yes, he did rib it a little bit in a classic VHS tape that came out. And I think, you know, there's copies of this tape still floating around. I had one for years before my film collection got destroyed 6 years ago. But it never got released on DVD, but it was called Horrible Horror. And it was a lot of fun. It had clips from all of those movies that we're talking about here. In fact, it was really the basis for bringing this podcast together. It's like, let's go back and relive some of those fun movies. And he had some fun with this one. But it was all done, you know, John Zacherle and a lot of these horror hosts, like Elvira and some of the others, yeah, they made fun of films, but it was in sort of a loving way. It wasn't in a cruel way. And I'm going to be kind to alligator people. Now, the director, I'm just going to mention briefly here, because he's probably a name that's not real familiar to most of you listening, was not familiar to me. Roy Del Ruth, who was not known for directing monster movies. In fact, this is really out of the ordinary for him. He directed a lot of lightweight type films like Topper Returns, which is really not a monster movie. It was more of, you know, that was sort of a lighthearted ghost movie. It was in the same league as Bewitched and some of those. It was a comedy. And of course, it spawned the Topper series. spawned a classic TV series in the 50s called Topper with Leo G. Carroll, and a funny, funny television series. And then also, Roy Del Ruth, one of his more successful films, was Broadway Melody of 1936. So he had a little experience in doing musicals. But now here he is directing a movie about people that turn into alligators or vice versa down in the Louisiana Bayou. And yes, this movie takes place in the Louisiana Bayou. So a lot of external shots. There weren't many uses of staging on this one. A few interiors that were, I think, clearly pretty much had to have been on a stage. But these actors, this had to be a rough shoot for them because they were in sort of a swamp setting for the exterior shots. So let's get things kicked off here with Alligator People. We told you about Lon Chaney Jr., Beverly Garland, George McCready, and Richard Crane. And I got to mention, Richard Crane is going to be familiar to some of you folks who are about my age or a little older. He was in the Rocky Jones Space Rangers television series and also in a movie that we will definitely be talking about here down the road. One that growing up was one of my all-time favorite fantasy science fiction type films and definitely a candidate for Monster Attack podcast, Mysterious Island. It was a favorite book of my grandfather's, and he also loved the movie when it came out in the 60s. And when I first saw Mysterious Island on television, I absolutely fell in love with it. This is one of the films that was introduced to me by my mother. Because, my dad and I, as I've shared many times on this podcast, I mean, my dad was the one that got me into monster movies. We shared a lot of movies together. But then occasionally mom had some good ones that she liked. And Mysterious Island was one of her favorites because she used to, she had that read to her by her father, my grandfather, when she'd go to bed at night as a little girl and then loved the movie. And Richard Crane was one of the leads in Mysterious Island. And definitely, I promise you, that is one that's going to be coming up very, very soon. Any excuse I have to watch that movie, you don't have to tell me twice. But let's get a little bit into the story here. It's really not a ludicrous story per se. I'm not a scientist, but I do a lot of reading and things like that. So may stretch a little of the science when we get into what these experiments were all about. But the movie starts out, the storytelling in this movie is pretty good. It's got a sandwiching story. In other words, there's a separate story that begins this film and ends this film. And it takes place in a sanitarium, the Webley Sanitarium. And we've got a couple of doctors that were introduced early on in the film. And one of the doctors is talking about this unusual case that he has, and he's consulting with his friend, a colleague who has driven quite a ways to be there. And he talks about this woman named Jane, who he's a little concerned about, and he wants a second opinion from his friend as to this psychological study that he is doing with this gal, Jane. Well, we find out very quickly that Jane isn't just a patient in the sanitarium. She actually works there. She works as this doctor's assistant. And he's been conducting some experiments, some psychological experiments with her involving hypnosis. So right off the bat, we get Jane, who is played by Beverly Garland, and she's agreed to be part of a subject of this. And this doctor's saying, yeah, I've put her under hypnosis a couple of times. I don't want to tell you anything about what you're going to hear. I don't want to influence you. I want your opinion on this coming in cold. So he gives her an injection. You have to assume this is 1959. It's probably something like scopolamine or sodium pentothal, the old truth serums that they would give people. And they put her in a hypnotic state. And she slowly starts telling her story, and right out of the blocks, he asks her, what's your name? And she gives a different name. Her name's not Jane, it's Joyce. She calls herself Joyce Webster, and then says, I was married to someone by the name of Paul Webster. I'm Mrs. Paul Webster, although I'm not sure if I ever really was married or not. And then the mystery starts. So now, basically, the movie is going to put you into the same seat as these two doctors as you're listening to this story that Beverly Garland's character is telling under hypnosis. And right off the bat, we find out she's married. She's on a train. They're heading for their honeymoon, she and this fella, Paul Webster, who is played by Richard Crane. And everything seems to be great. They're very happy. We find out that Joyce Webster, I'm going to call her Joyce from here on out, was a nurse, a military nurse. Richard was a military pilot. He had had a bad plane crash, and they had met when he was going through rehabilitation in an Army hospital. And she makes a comment. She says, I would have had no idea that you had been so seriously injured in this plane crash. Because he said, you know, most of my bones were broken. My skin was burned. I was in terrible shape. I was lucky that I survived. I probably should have been dead. And that's how they met. They fell in love. And then when they both were discharged from the military, they got married. And now they're on this train heading out on their honeymoon. Well, during the train ride, they're looking at their telegrams. They get a series of telegrams from friends and well-wishers for you know, like, congratulations on your marriage and all this stuff. Now, we don't know at this time where the train is going. But one of the telegrams Paul opens up and looks at, Richard Crane does some great acting with this, just the way his face just drops, you know, something serious has happened. And of course, Joyce picks up on it and says, what's wrong? What's the matter? And he gets up and he walks out of the compartment and he grabs the porter and he said, what's the next stop that this train is making? And that porter says, well, it's stopping in about, you know, just stopping just in a few seconds here. We're making a mail run, but we only stop here for half a minute and there's no time for anyone to get off and walk around. And he goes, is there a phone there where we're stopping? He says, yeah, there's a telephone there. He says, fine. And he leaves. Now, because Joyce doesn't know what's going on. Also, she's looking out the window of the train and she sees Paul out there after the train has stopped on the stationway. And she's pounding on the window trying to get his attention. And he walks off and the train takes off. And she goes running out to the porter. We've got to stop the train. We've got to stop the train. You know, he's gone. He's gone. He's gone. And of course, now as Joyce is telling the story. And again, folks, I'm going to be jumping over this story pretty rapidly because I want you to see this movie and experience it for yourself as well. Basically, what happens is Joyce gets off on the next stop, and then she manages to get back to the stop that Paul got off on, the little mail stop. And of course, he's not there, and now he has totally vanished. She has no idea where he went. Well, as she's relaying this story to the doctors, she relates that she finds a fraternity pin, and she discovers that Paul belonged to a fraternity, and the chapter was located on the campus of Louisiana State University, LSU. So she figures, let's go see if we can find out where Paul is. And she gets down to LSU and she starts sifting through their records and she finds an address. And it's an address in Louisiana and it's Bayou Landing, Louisiana. So now you know we're going to be in the bayou. We're going to be in a swamp. And she hops a train down there. And as she gets off the train, you know, the conductor's like, are you sure this is where you want to get off? Because it looks like a ghost town. She said, nope, let me off. And boom, she's looking around. It's like a deserted town. Nobody there. And she's walking around and she sees this large crate that has Cobalt 60 on the label. And it's going to the Cypresses. And she's paying close attention to it. When an old truck pulls up that has a label on the door that says the Cypresses, and it's been driven by Lon Chaney, whose character is named Mannion. And he gets out of the truck and he says, you couldn't have just gotten off the train, did you? He says, there's not another train through here, you know, until the next morning. And she says, yes, I'm looking for somebody. And by any chance, are you driving out to the Cypresses? And he says, well, yes, ma'am, I am. Are they expecting you? And she says, no, but I need to get out there. I'm looking for my husband and I need to talk with them out there if I can. And he goes, well, you know, you could tell he's taking a little bit of a shine to her. Mannion's a little bit of a lech here. And he goes, I'll trust you. Let's say, you know, jump on in. He says, I've got a haul, you know, you get in the truck and I'm going to go put this crate in the truck and then we'll drive off. And they're driving out there. Apparently, it's very obvious from the way this is shot and the way the story's being told. they're a long way from town. They're a long way from this train station. And they're going out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we're talking, I mean, to say it was a dirt road is being kind. It is some of the roughest terrain you're ever going to see. And they're getting right into the heart of the bayou. I mean, talking about in the middle of nowhere, they're in the middle of nowhere. Really awful conditions. And as they get out there, they stop for a minute because they see a couple of guys wrestling an alligator off the side of the road. And he says, I bet you never saw anything like that. These guys grab this alligator and they, they get him tied up, get his snout tied up, and they throw him into a boat and they go rowing off. And off they go. And then later on down, as they're going down the road, one thing as a kid when I first saw this, and I still, they do this so well, don't notice that Lon Chaney's character doesn't have his right hand. It's a hook, so he's lost his hand. You got to figure, he lost it in the bio. I wonder how that happened. And of course, first thing I thought it was Captain Hook, Peter Pan. It had to be a crocodile, alligator, or whatever. And the gators down there. And we see a gator come climbing out of the swamp and crawling out onto the roadway. And of course, Chaney goes, he's cussing it out. He hits the gas and runs it over. He doesn't hurt it. And Joyce is like, what did you do that for? But he didn't hurt anybody. He goes, he took my arm. He took my hand. Look at this. This is how I got it. I'll kill any gator that I find. I can't stand those things after what they did to me. Well, they finally get to the cypresses and, old Mannion takes off in the truck because he's got to go deliver this this crate to wherever he's going. Joyce knocks on the door. It's answered by a servant who says, are you expected? And she says, no. And a lady is coming down the stairway. We can see her coming down the stairway. And it's Mrs. Henry Hawthorne. That's who she identifies herself as. And she says, you've got to leave. You can't stay here. And she says, well, I'm looking for my husband. I'm looking for Paul Webster. And this is an address that has been associated with his name, according to Louisiana State University. Mrs. Hawthorne is like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. You can't stay here. You've got to go. And the butler reminds her, he says, well, ma'am, there's no train until tomorrow. And she says, well, I guess we need to let her stay the night. We can't just throw her out in the middle of the bayou. So you can stay here for the night. We will offer you our hospitality. Willingly, all I ask is that you do not leave your room. And then first thing in the morning, we will take you down to the train station so you can catch the next train. Sorry, you came all this way and didn't find out what was going on. I couldn't find any answers about your missing husband. So later that evening, Joyce is up in her room. They brought her dinner. I mean, she's basically like in jail. And she hears shooting going on out there. And then we see that Lon Chaney is out there shooting at the gators. Now, of course, he's shooting with a revolver, which anyone who knows anything about animals knows that that's not going to do much for an alligator. I mean, it's like shooting an armored car. And he's not getting anywhere. He chases him off, basically. Of course, Mrs. Hawthorne says to the butler, says, go out there and stop him. He's clearly drunk, and that girl is here, and she doesn't need, he doesn't need to be doing that with her around. And the butler goes out and tells Mannion, he says, look, you got to stop it. You got to stop the shoot. He goes, yeah, but they took my arm, and I'm going to kill them all. He goes, I know, I understand, but that girl is here, and we've got to be very careful about what's going on. So very early on, after Joyce gets here, we realize these people are covering up some kind of a secret. They're hiding something. And of course, we got to assume that they must know something about Paul, and they're just not telling her. Well, Joyce is getting a little suspicious as well. She suspects something is up. She sort of quizzes the other servant in the house, a maid, and says, what's going on around here? Is someone, hiding something? Are they trying to keep me from seeing something? And the maid just says, ma'am, this is a troubled house. When you get the chance to leave, you need to leave. You just need to leave. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to say any more. Now we cut over to Mrs. Hawthorne, who makes this phone call to another residence that's somewhere far away, and talks to Dr. Mark Sinclair, played by George McCready. And she says, the girl's here. She's asking about him. And now we find out that, as we suspected, Mrs. Hawthorne knows all about Paul Webster. And says, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he says, look, I'll handle it. I'll see what I can do. I will talk to her. And while we're seeing this conversation going on, we realize that that this doctor, Mark Sinclair's got like a clinic or something, because it cuts to these attendants that are wrestling with this guy in bed. He's making some weird noises, so he's injured or something, but he's not sounding human. But that gets our curiosity up as well. But we're left with the fact that after this guy's given an injection, he settles down, and then we see the attendants leave, and we see the face of this patient, now that he's settled down, is very strangely shaped. It almost doesn't look human. So that gets things going. So now we're following this mystery. What in the world is going on? And he's all bandaged up, so we can't see his face. Now, the other thing that raises our curiosity about what's going on there is that there's a brief conversation between the attendants and Dr. Sinclair about some tests going on, and how this was number 6. So we know now we've got some kind of human experimentation going on. And number 6 didn't do well this time out, and apparently they're looking for some kind of cure or antidote or something. But we were left with that as we cut back to the house, back to the cypresses, where Joyce hears music. She hears piano playing. Now, we have seen that somebody has come in through a side window into, I guess I'll call it the parlor of this large mansion, and starts playing the piano. So she makes her way out. She's able to get out of the room. She's not locked in. And she sneaks down, and she's watching this guy who's playing at the piano. And she waits, and then she says something, and the guy doesn't want her to see her face. You know, we can't really see his face. We can tell it's sort of disfigured. It's in the shadows, and we can't make it out. And he runs off, and she runs after him to try to talk to him. Now we figure out we can tell. And this is really well done. There's some great shots in here where they make good use of lighting and shadowing and stuff. So we really can't see detail of this guy's face, and we have to assume it's Paul. I mean, I don't think there's any bones about the fact that as you're watching this film, this is who you're going to figure out it is, that this is who she's looking for. But he is disfigured. Now, the one criticism I'm going to make here, and it's a mild one, and it's one that's like, God, I wish you guys hadn't done this. A lot of these low-budget films become very dependent upon narration. And, you know, they do that because it saves time and money. But in the case of the alligator people, we've got some narration going on here where the narrator comes in and says, you know, Joyce comes downstairs to investigate what is happening, why this music is coming out of the parlor, and she has to see. And it's like, she did well enough. This was shot well enough where I think the audience is intelligent enough to sort of know that. They don't need this guy telling it. And I think the film would be stronger, and that scene would be so much stronger without the narrator getting in the way. And there's a couple of times in the beginning, definitely in the first half of this film, where a narrator comes in and interrupts, and it gets in the way. And I really, really wish that that hadn't been put in there. If I was to go back, I'll put it this way. If I was going to go back and make a fan version of this film, I'd keep it basically the same and just pull those narrated sections out, because you don't need them. The story is strong enough, is being told strong enough, where you don't need the narrator getting it away. But that's just a little pet peeve I have. And a lot of times I get disturbed by some narration. We've talked about it on this podcast before. And of course, there have been just some really bad movies that have resorted to using it, and taking the narration out wouldn't have made it any better. In this case, I think the movie would have been better if the narration had been taken out. Well, immediately after this scene, this fellow shows back up at the cypresses once Joyce has gone back up into her room, and he's talking to Mrs. Hawthorne. Clearly, they know each other, and this is where, if you didn't suspect that Mrs. Hawthorne was Paul's mother, now you find out for sure that she is his mother, because he makes it very apparent. I mean, they reveal that, and we get a better look at Paul's face, and it's all scaly, and it's disfigured, and he's talking about this cobalt experiment that the doctor has told him is just too dangerous, but he says, I want to do it, and it may be my only hope. And now remember back, the big crate had cobalt written on it, so we know there's a connection. So now we know that very clearly that this Dr. Mark Sinclair probably has something to do with this experiment that Paul is talking about. We don't know in detail yet what it is, but we immediately are left hanging with that to find out what's going to happen. And this is one thing I like about this movie, is you really do want to find out what's going to happen next. Well, we have your proverbial thunder and lightning storm in the bayou, and it's very spooky. It's very well staged, very well shot. And Joyce is at the house, and Paul sneaks back in, and Joyce catches him and confronts him, and he runs out of the house again, and this time she chases him into the swamp in the middle of a thunderstorm. You know, not a smart thing to do. And of course, I'll tell you what, I'm not sure how exactly they did this. I mean, I always wonder about the safety of the actors in a film like this. But, I mean, they're using real alligators in this film. All I can figure is somehow they've got them where they can't move, but so far they must be on a tether or something, because Beverly Garland is going through these bad swamp patches where these alligators are hissing at her and almost on top of her. I'll tell you what, she had guts to do this one. I just don't know how dangerous this pot. Well, dangerous enough if you're around a gator, something could go wrong. And they're all doing their own stunts. These aren't stunt people. You're seeing them full bore on, and this is them doing it. But she goes through this swamp. She's the moccasins are after her. The gators are after her. And she's getting near this cabin where Mannion lives. And Mannion looks out and he hears her screaming. And he runs out and basically finds her passed out and gets her back to his cabin. And she comes to, and he makes the move on her. You know, right out of his mouth, he says, "You know, I did save your life. Maybe, you know, you think maybe you owe me something there." And you go, "Boy, you know where this is going." And then he looks at her and says, "Oh, you're freezing cold. You need to get out of those wet clothes. Go ahead, get out of those wet clothes." And you know, it's like, okay, I mean, he's not even being subtle. Sort of like, "You know, I saved your life. Get out of your clothes. You know what's coming next." And then she's not taking her clothes off. And he's, "Well, here, let me wrap you up in this blanket, at least keep you warm." And of course, that gives him a reason to get his arms wrapped around her. And he's starting going after her. And he's really, you know, this is it. We've got a rape scene, you know, just seconds away when Paul breaks into the cabin. He bursts into the cabin. And now, we've had a chance to sort of see him full on and see that his skin is very scaly and his face is all distorted and stuff. And he and Mannion get into this big fight. It's pretty well choreographed. And I think there may be some stunt people involved with this one. But suffice to say that Mannion doesn't win this fight. And Paul knocks him out or knocks him down long enough to pick up Joyce and carry her off. And this is one of the classic scenes from the alligator people. In fact, this is the one that John Zachary used when he was having fun with this movie, where it shows Lon Chaney Jr. running out, you know, onto the porch of this cabin and screaming, "I'll kill you, alligator man! I'll kill you!" And when I think of this movie, I always think of that scene. That is the scene that defines this movie. "I'll kill you!" Well, Joyce is now, she's passed out. She's taken upstairs. The maid is told, you know, take care of her. Paul is there, and now Mrs. Hawthorne, who we sort of think is maybe a bad person. We get a sort of comeuppance on this because she's saying, "Paul, you've got to tell her. This is your wife. I don't want her to see me this way." Well, and she says, "Well, she's seen you this way. You've got to tell her what's going on. She suspects it's you. She has a right to know." And he says, "No, I want this treatment. I got to have this treatment." And he leaves it at that. And he just says, I'm just not going to tell her. Well, suffice to say, the next day, Joyce doesn't take off on the train. She stays there. Apparently, she's going to stay there until she gets some answers. So Mark Sinclair decides that he's going to just tell her what's going on. And he invites her over to his clinic. It's his laboratory, basically. And he talks about how Mrs. Hawthorne, after she got married, after Mr. Webster died, her name was Webster, financed his experiments. And he was doing experiments with animals and their relationship to humans. And to suffice to say, he uses as an example some reptiles that can regrow limbs. You cut their tail off and they regrow it. And the chemicals that are involved in their bodies that would cause it. And he mentions hydrocortisone as a healing agent, which it's still used as a healing agent nowadays in creams and topical solutions. But he says he found in his experimentation, he found a chemical that was existent in alligators that promoted advanced healing in human beings. And when he tried it on Paul, who, as you remember, was in a serious plane crash and should have been dead, as he said, by his own volition, he should have been dead. Paul makes a miraculous recovery, an absolutely miraculous recovery. And when we saw Paul in the beginning of this story that Joyce is telling. He looks perfectly normal. But the catch is that after a year, all of a sudden, there's some kind of rebound effect, and the person starts basically becoming like an alligator. And so now that explains the scaly skin that we've seen, and Paul is reverting back. He's reverting into some kind of alligator-human hybrid. And the hope is that using this Cobalt 60 might counteract that rebound effect and turn Paul back into a human being. Paul insists that they do it. And, you know, because Dr. Sinclair is saying, look, no, we need more testing on that. And Paul says, nope, I want to take the risk. I want it tonight. It's decided they're going to do it that night. Now, Mrs. Hawthorne finds out that now Joyce knows everything that she needs to know. And suffice to say, they have a reconciliation. And Joyce says, I know you were just trying to protect him and do what he wanted. And Mrs. Hawthorne says, you know, you actually are a pretty decent person. And you make him very happy. And I hope this works. Now, McCready goes to great lengths to explain that he can only expose Paul to this cobalt gamma ray for 30 seconds anymore. He doesn't know what's going to happen. It's very, very dangerous, so they've got to be very precise in what they do. They've got Paul strapped down where the ray is going to be shot into him. And while that's happening, Mannion breaks in. He's looking for the alligator man. He's upset because of the fight they had the night before. He's clearly drunk. And of course, he breaks in. He screws everything up. Paul gets exposed to the ray too long. The machinery starts overloading and blowing up. And we all of a sudden look, and Paul is full bore alligator in his head, in his face. And this is the only other little criticism I have of the movie. Up until this point, this is a pretty good little movie, you know, and even the scientific explanations and stuff for, you know, I put on the 1959 filter. And it's like, yeah, this, I'll go with this. It's, I don't have to suspend so much disbelief. I can't believe this movie. But the final makeup effect, now I thought the makeup effect of Paul's deformity and stuff like that was pretty decent, but the alligator head doesn't work. And when we see Paul and with his shirt off and the full alligator head, it is clearly a rubber suit. I mean, there's just no way around it, because what happens is everybody gets out of the lab. It catches on fire. It eventually blows up, and Paul runs out into the swamp. And of course, Joyce is right behind him, looking for him. Paul gets into a fight with an alligator, and he doesn't do very well. I mean, he does subdue the alligator, and as he's running away, he falls into quicksand, which has been established earlier that there's quicksand in the bayou, and you never take anything for granted in any of these movies. And he blooped underneath the quicksand, and he's gone. Now, that's not where the movie ends. But, and again, I say it's during these sections you can really tell it's very obvious that it's a rubber suit. And I wish there was some other way that they could have done this. I think this is a case where if you use some light and shadowing and it really didn't show us the exact details of the alligator head and the body, this movie would have been very effective. But that's hindsight. What happens in the movie is, now Joyce is the end of her session. We're back to the two doctors in Webley Sanitarium. And he goes, what should I do? And the guy says, well, clearly she's been through a traumatic experience. And now she is fine. I mean, she's taken on this new name and new identity. She's coping. And the guy says, yeah, she's a perfect assistant. She seems to be fine, not bothered by this at all. And I'm torn. Should I tell her? And he says, you know, if I play this tape for her, then she's going to know. I mean, she's just totally suppressed this memory. What should I do? Well, they decide they're not going to tell her. And that's the end of the movie. And this is sort of the beginning of that independent era, mid-60s, late 70s, where movies didn't have to have a definitive ending, where they sort of left you thinking, I wonder if maybe somewhere down the road, Joyce, Jane, whoever she wants to call herself, didn't have some kind of flashback or, you know, repressed memories. So many movies and stories out there about repressed memories coming back and causing a person problems. You know, and in the 50s, movies generally up until this point just had either a happy ending or a sad ending, but this one just sort of leaves you guessing. And that was one thing I did like about this film. But with the exception of the overindulgent narration and the very bad makeup effect at the end, I like this movie. It's an entertaining movie. As a kid, we got a real kick out of it. I mean, it's a guy turning into an alligator. But I mean, even as an adult, it keeps your attention. It moves very quickly. It is not so ludicrous that it just becomes a joke. And I would say, watch The Alligator People. If for some reason you've never seen it, look, this is not Academy Award winning material, but again, it's another one of those popcorn munchers that for 77 minutes, you can have some fun with it, get some people over and have a good time. And you can have a little bit of a loving laugh with it. But again, I can't be cruel with this movie. And I think the actors and the performances in this movie are very good. Scripting could be a little stronger and a little better. But all in all, for a low-budget film like this, unlike many of the ones we've talked about coming out of this time period, it's not bad. Anyway, it's all about having fun and fond memories, and I'll always have a fond memory of this film. This was one of those other ones. You know, do I want to call it a full-fledged guilty pleasure? I don't know if I'm going to go that far, because that still implies a bad movie that I enjoyed a lot. This isn't a bad movie. But it's a fun movie, and it's a bit ludicrous, but it's very entertaining. And, you know, cuddle up with your favorite significant other or get some friends over to the house, you know, pump up a whole lot of popcorn and plant yourself in front of the TV, and for an hour and 17 minutes, have a lot of fun, and then talk about it afterwards, and you'll have a good evening's entertainment. Hey, folks, next week we have another one in store for you, and we'll keep you guessing as to what other film I'm pulling out from my childhood past, from my Monster Movie Matinee past, to talk about on Monster Attack. But before I leave you, I do want to remind you to please pay a visit to our sponsor site, SubcultureCorsetsAndClothing.com. Don't forget, SubcultureCorsetsAndClothing.com. You won't regret it. They have been a longtime sponsor of Monster Attack, and we certainly appreciate their support. And we hope to see you again next week on Monster Attack. Hey, folks, I want to tell you about some friends of mine, Crystal Lake Publishing. You know, with unmatched success since 2012, Crystal Lake Publishing has quickly become one of the world's leading indie publishers of horror, mystery, thriller, and suspense books with a dark fiction edge. Yeah, love it. Crystal Lake Publishing is run by a truly international team led by South Africa's Joe Meinhardt, and they put integrity, honor, and respect at the forefront of their operations. So folks, I want you to visit CrystalLakePub.com for more information on Crystal Lake Publishing, Tales from the Darkest Depths. That's CrystalLakePub.com for more information on Crystal Lake Publishing, Tales from the Darkest Depths. I promise you, you're going to love it.
The hour of the weird and unexplained. Join your hosts, Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross, as they take you on an entertaining journey through the mysteries of the world and the universe. Paranormal, true crime, conspiracies, unexplained phenomena.
Listen to 13 o'clock on the Project Entertainment Network and find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at 13 o'clock podcast.
Rated R.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.